track session number 23216 reel 9.
Colonel Corbould, reel 9. You were saying that once the reservists had been brought up to fitness and their weapon skills had been brushed up, they went off to battalions. Where were the battalions?
The battalions, as far as I remember, were all in Aldershot at that time. The 3rd Battalion was the one selected to do the actual drop at Elgamal Airfield under a man called Paul Crook. And the other two battalions were in support. Two para at that time was commanded by a man, a marvellous man, a retired general now called Barla Breeden, Royal Ulster Rifles. And I can't remember who was commanding the 1st Battalion at that time. Anyway, they were all in Aldershot at that time, yes. And of course, as you know, it came to about November when the actual drop took place. I think it was the 5th of November, something like that, in 56, when the actual drop at Suez took place. I was then in hospital, having just broken my right ankle very badly indeed.
How did you manage to do that?
Jumping out of an aeroplane. And I was very angry indeed, because I wanted to get myself into a battalion then. But that was the end of that. And it put me on a great collision course for some time. Because I hadn't, and to this day, have trouble with the ankle.
How did you manage to do that then? Was this your first jump for some time?
No, it was an ordinary routine jump which we had to do every, well, not every certain, but one jump whenever one could. Mm. And it was one of those routine jumps, and Frensham Common, and it landed in a pothole. And my right ankle stuck fast, and I went over the top.
That's just a bit of bad luck.
Very bad luck, but it could happen to anyone.
Mm. And were you on track to getting into a battalion at that?
Yes, it was. I was just getting back on track, yes, mm. Yes.
Which battalion were you going to
go to? I was hoping to go to the 1st Battalion, but in fact I went 2 years later.
But they didn't jump anyway, did they, seriously?
No, they didn't, no, no. No, the only battalion that's really jumped since the war is C Power at Elgamal. On operations.
On operations.
Now, steady on. I may be wrong. Didn't some people do that in Sierra Leone? Didn't two parrot?
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did. Yes.
Mm.
Well, I have to be very careful, I say about that. Very careful indeed.
What was the appointment you were going to have in one parrot?
A company commander. Mm. And then eventually I went and commanded support company in one parrot, yes.
What happened to you then after you damaged yourself, you've broken the ankle?
I then stayed in command of recruit company as best I could. Mm. I did it all from my company office virtually. And I have a very loud voice. I used to shout people, four people right, left and centre. They all just come running. And that's about the best I could do. I did a hell of a lot of physiotherapy, of course, as well. Mm. And that held me up for, well, a couple of years, getting back to a battalion. And then in 1958, I went to the 1st Battalion.
What were they doing when you joined them?
They were in Aldershot, and we were all preparing to go on a huge exercise in Norway, which we did in 1958-59. And I commanded support company, which was the machine guns, mortars, anti-tank, signals.
I was going to ask you if there had been any innovations or changes in the weapons and equipment since you'd first joined airborne forces
in 1948, yes.
Mm. Well,
I suppose I think we had the GP, we still had the Vickers machine gun then. Mm. We still had the 3-inch mortar. Do I not know? Jumping with the base plate of a mortar, it's quite a heavy thing to jump with. Now signals, I suppose our radios had improved a good deal, but for anti-tank, I think the Wombat had just about come out then.
The recoilless rifle.
Yes, yes. Yes, we no longer had the sort of 6 pound or 17 pound. I think it was the Wombat. Gosh, I had to really search my. You're putting me to the test, Nigel. Anyway.
Where did you go in Norway?
We landed at Trondheim. Mm. Then we met up and dropped in the Arctic Circle at a place called Bardufoss. Mm. And in many ways, I'm told, it was a German invasion in reverse. And we were there as a brigade group.
Did you jump at Trondheim?
I didn't, no. I was still a bit. They kept me back from parachuting for a bit, even when I got to the battalion. Mm.
What about the battalion? Did they jump, or any of them jump at one time?
Yes, they did. Each battalion jumped at one person did, yes.
Do you know where? Was it near, very close to Trondheim, or
Bonnie was right up in the Arctic Circle.
You hadn't dropped Trondheim then?
No, that was a base. That was the base. Again. Then they flew off and dropped at Bardufoss. And that's inside the Arctic Circle, whither we went.
What time of year was that? Were you dropping into snow? Or?
Yes. Let me think now. It must have been about September, October time.
What was the overall scenario for the exercise? Do you remember?
I think it was a battalion in the attack and river crossing, as far as I remember, yes. What I do remember is the fact that we had only recently taken having two parachutes to jump with.
I think you said something about the value of the reserve chute.
Yes, and that's when it came out. Mm. We had two chaps who would certainly not be alive today. One of them was called Calisvant Saul, remember him well. And he very nearly candle, pulled his reserve, and that was all well. Thereafter, we all said, thank God for the reserve.
Was this an opposed exercise?
No. No, we didn't have any. I don't think even the Norwegians opposed us in any way. It was just an exercise, rehearsing a battalion in the attack and doing river crossing. It was a very hard exercise indeed.
Are there any particular aspects to parachuting in Arctic conditions?
Not as far as I know. No, we didn't have any skis to get on or anything like that. Mm. We just parachuted into the snow. Mm. It was a very nice, soft landing.
How did you get on with the Norwegians?
Very well indeed. At the end of this long exercise, we gave a great brigade group party back in Trondheim. And my goodness me, because the Norwegians like whiskey very much. And thereby hangs many a tale. But grace with me, I've never seen men and women drink whiskey like it. We were absolutely appalled. Anyway, but that's beside the point.
Well, if you only get an opportunity once in a while, you have to make the most of it.
Well, that's what you do. Yes. But we got on with them extremely well. Very nice people indeed. And also, of course, our brigade commander's wife at that time was a Norwegian, Brigadier Tom Pearson, now retired General Tom Pearson. His wife is a Norwegian. So that was a good start.
She was going home, or did she come out on the exercise?
I don't think she did. No, I don't think so. No.
I think 1958 was also the year of the deployment to Jordan. Did you have anything to do with that?
I didn't have anything to do with that at all. No, there was two para. I think General Michael Forrester. I think that was his thing in his baby entirely. I think it was two para.
Well, I think there were two battalions.
It would have been two and three. It would have been two and three years.
What was one doing then while they were?
No, I can't remember. I just cannot remember at all. Mm. I think we were sort of exercising at home and doing various things.
Because I think the brigade went out to Cyprus because the...
Oh, the AOKA business started up. Of course it did. Yes.
Part of the cover for the preparation for the intervention in Jordan was that it was to build up the Cyprus garrison.
That's right.
The internal security.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I'd forgotten about that, yes. Mm. Which really brings me on to my next job. It was then decided that as I hadn't been to the staff college, I couldn't pass it. I didn't in fact take the exam. But it was thought I should go for this thing called SQ.
Staff qualifier.
Yes, which people had to go in for.
But you'd already done two jobs of administration, hadn't you?
Well, I'd done that. But they didn't reckon as a staff job there.
Didn't count.
They said it was a staff job. So I was sent off in 1959-60. 1960 to 38 group based at Odium, which was an army support group. And I was sent there as the G2 Airborne. And for 2 years, this was a Packer staff job, for 2 years I flew the world with the RAF. Oh. And I made a list of the things here. We did an enormous exercise in Libya. I went to Malta 6 times in that 2 years. I went to Cyprus 18 times in that 2 years. I went at about 3 days' notice to Cyprus. I went to Kenya and to Aden, and that was all part of contingency planning. Mm. Now, I must tell you this. I can't, I'm not allowed to tell you much more about that. Even to this day, some things are rather sort of, I'm not meant to talk about it too much. But all I will say was, it was all contingency planning. Mm. And then I went also to Pakistani Air Force Staff College at Karachi. And I did about 3 weeks there on a tour with a wing commander and an air commodore. All very interesting indeed.
What were the primary functions and scope of your job as G2 Airborne at Odeon?
Well, when anything sort of to do with airborne forces came up, because I was the chap who was always blown for. A great deal of it was selection of dropping zones. And the number of people would have been required to hold the dropping zone before the main body arrived, this sort of thing. but why I'm not allowed to any more details is the fact that in those places at that time I mentioned, there was an enormous amount of undercover work going on.
Mm. Well, I know that in Libya there was a threat of power seizure, which was being promoted by the Egyptians around about that time, and we had usually an armoured squadron there.
Well, that is public knowledge. I would agree with that. Yes, yes, yes.
And we were certainly looking at places like El Adem and.
Well, I did a lot. I spent a lot of time at El Adem. Yes, yes. Mm. And in a place called Tamimi.
Yes. We were making contingency plans for intervention operations all the way around the Mediterranean. And, also around.
But some were more urgent than others. I can assure you.
Of course. do you remember ever having anything to do with planning to go into the Sudan? Because that was bubbling up at the time.
We didn't do any contingency planning down there, no.
Because they were thinking about flying in troops. I think flying them in directly in civil airlines to Khartoum. I don't think they were thinking about jumping.
That didn't come my way at all. No. But we did a lot of involved contingency planning in Kenya. Mm. But I didn't really get involved in that.
No. Well, Kenya, of course, was just independent, wasn't it? 1937, Kenya had become mm. And I think we were still... We still had garrison in Kenya at that time.
Oh, we did. Yes, yeah. Yes,
East African... HQ East African Forces, I think.
That's right, yes. I'm just trying to think of the name of the general there. It's rather a peculiar name. But yes, we did have a garrison there. You're quite right, yes.
Were you in any sense a sort of liaison officer for the army to the RAF?
Yes, I was. Very, very much so. We had another chap who was called the G2 Air Transport, AT. And so, and then we had our little cell was commanded by a colonel. So then under him there was myself and this other chap, who was an RESC chap.
Were you using Army staff procedures or Air Force staff procedures in your work?
In my work, I used entirely Army staff procedures, yes. Sometimes there was a bit of a confrontation sort of came about.
I was going to ask how, you know, whether this ever led to any sort of friction with your Air Force colleagues.
Oh, it did, yes, and it did at times, yes. Mm. And what I found so extraordinary being with the Air Force was that if you were put on duty in the operations room, which I was, like the other people were as well, and decisions had to be made, you had to make them on the spot. That's what you were there for. And on one particular occasion, there was a drop going to take place in the desert, and I was on duty. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the forecast came through saying that it would be absolutely nonsensical to put a parachute down in at dawn this morning. There's a gale blowing, or there's a sandstorm, and so on and so forth. And the airman said, "We must have a decision now." I said, "Right, I'm the G2 airborne. The thing will not take place." The following morning, I got marched in. "Who are you to make such a decision?" said the SASO, senior staff officer. I said, "That's what I'm trained to do. It's what I'm supposed to do. I'm on your staff. You put me on duty. A decision had to be made. And I made the decision on very good grounds indeed." That didn't get on very well.
Do you think, from your observation, the Air Force was rather more centralised in its decision-making than the Army?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And, of course, they're so rank conscious, too. Oh. My word, they were rank conscious.
More so than the Army?
Oh, far more so. Yeah, far more so, even than the Navy. And the God knows they can be a bit rank conscious. But the Air Force, I found, mind you, this is going back all those years, 1959, 60, 61, I found them very rank conscious indeed. it was really rather ridiculous. They were talking about reducing the armed forces at that time, and I, as a joke, got up at some little conference that we had and so on. So I said, well, I think of a very good way of reducing the armed forces. For example, I would think that fighter command could go into the light infantry division, and that the bomber command could go into the gunners, and went on something like this, rather tongue-in-cheek. My goodness me, did I get a rocket?
You would have got a very strong reaction.
I got a very strong reaction.
Because since its foundation, the Royal Air Force has suspected that there is a plot to reconvert it to the Royal Flying Corps, the Royal Naval Air Service.
That's right. Yes. I think they saw visions of this coming up. Yes. This wretched vehicle.
Well, once the manned bomber ceased to be a viable system.
Proposition, yes.
And there was no logic.
Exactly. Anyway, but... However, I got a good confidential report out of it.
What was the rank of this senior air staff officer who was an
Air Vice Marshal.
An Air Vice Marshal.
And he'd been a Battle of Britain pilot, a man called Wynne, very nice man. He and I got on actually very well in the end, very well indeed.
I was going to ask how you got on with them at a personal level.
Oh, very well. Very well indeed.
Institutional.
Yes, yes. They were also highly delighted to know that my late wife, because she was with me on the stage, and she was originally a Royal Air Force nursing sister. So I couldn't go wrong there.
What about their social life? How did that compare to social life in the army? Oh, you
know, very much the battalion. Same. Very much the same. They were very good indeed, yes. We entertained each other's houses a great deal. And, we got on with them extremely well. Very well indeed.
You're saying that one of your main jobs was to identify drop zones or landing zones. Mm. What would you look for when you were trying to find one?
You would have to make quite certain that there were in all these various places, you didn't want boulders on the ground. So therefore, one had to go to all these various places in all these countries that I mentioned now and literally search on the ground. Mm. What were the trees? What was the wind normally like at various times of the day? So you have to go and meet people. And also, you had to make quite certain that you had your forces for coming forward, which is usually the Guards Parachute Company, to hold the ground before the main body arrived. Where would they go? So they all had to be wrecked on the ground before all these things took place.
So you're really looking at it from the point of view of defensive.
Yes.
Positions, as well as whether you could actually land parachutes.
That is right. And where would they go? What would the objectives be after they'd actually landed? Mm. So that was, it took a lot of thought before one even got onto the ground. Mm. Maps.
Ah. So, in other words, you'd start with a map study, yes, presumably, and then you would go and look when you'd identified likely places.
Correct,
from the map study.
Correct, yes. Which it was a terribly time-consuming performance, I can assure you. Mm.
But it is indispensable.
Oh, it's indispensable, yes, mm, yes, yes.
Did you manage to use air photographs at all as a way of identifying potential drop zones?
Not a great deal. I mean, I did obviously look at them, yes, but I found the maps were more interesting, instructive.
Where were you getting your directions about which countries to examine? Was this coming down through the Army chain of command or the Air Force chain of command?
Well, both.
Both.
Both War Office and our Ministry. Mm. Was it that in those days? Was it MOD in those days? I can't remember.
Well, MOD hadn't yet been created, I think. But Duncan Sands decided in 1957 that such a thing was necessary.
Yes, it had actually taken place.
Yeah. And it was beginning to form, I suppose, 58.
Yes.
They'd have been trying to.
But this all came from the joint staffs.
Yes.
Really.
So it would be.
It was Army and Air Force.
Ah. Would that have been joint planning staff or joint intelligence staff?
Both.
Both.
Both. I mean, obviously, intelligence came into it a great deal. Mm. As in everything. Mm. Without the intelligence, you can't plan anything at all.
Well, that's quite right. Well, why were you going to Cyprus so often? Was this for exercise purposes, or because Cyprus was a mounting base for possible forward operations?
Well, I must be very careful what I say here, even now. I suppose it was a mounting base. But for what, I'm not going to say any more at all. Mm. There was a lot of undercover planning going on at that time.
Mm. And what about Malta? What was there at Malta that was
same again?
Interesting?
Mm. And of course, at that time, because we keep our eye on Gaddafi and all that crowd. In, well, he hadn't come into power then, but
no, it was still King Idris.
Idris then, yes. Mm. but it was very useful for that sort of performance there. Mm-hmm. Yes, and also, of course, things were not awfully good in North Africa at that time with the French.
Well, the French were beginning to get really worked up, weren't they, with the trouble in Algeria.
Yeah. Mm. Well, this is what I mean. I don't want to get into that.
Did you have any liaison with the French?
Yeah. Mm.
What about the Navy? Because they were still interested in Malta.
Oh, yes, had a lot of liaison with the Navy. We liaised with them a great deal and got their intelligence reports through as well.
Valletta was still a major facility.
Very much so. Grand Harbour. Very much so, yes.
Did you spend any length of time at all in Cyprus? Did you get any impression of the operations against AOKA while you were there?
Well, yes, I did. I mean, again, I used to go to the headquarters there, which was in the general there, was then General Darling, who I knew very well indeed from Melbourne days, and who always has remained a very great friend. He's now dead. But, yes, I used to get a briefing from his staff, certainly. Mm. And I got the impression that, really, we were doing awfully well. Very, very well indeed. And of course, the morale, I found the morale of the troops was very good there too, very good. And yes, I got a very favourable impression of what we were doing against the AOKA terrorists, yes. Mm. And they were absolute sensei.
Around about that time, there were plans, I think, which kept being on and then off for small scale airborne operation, probably about company level, into the Radfan Mountains, and I think also another one into Dhofar in Muscat and Oman.
That is true, because there was a war going on there in Muscat, and of course the commander of the British troops, there was a British general.
Mm.
Yes, there was a lot of that going on too.
I mean, were you concerned at all with trying to identify
Yes, that's right. When you say Aden, yes.
And are there practicable drop zones in Dhofar?
Not really, no. Not really. It's very rugged indeed. No.
I would have thought you'd have had a very high level of injury if you tried to jump.
I absolutely certainly would, yes.
And the Radfan are also quite inhospitable, aren't they?
Well, it's like the northwest frontier of India. I mean, one look and one had to say negative.
Yeah.
On foot.
Yes.
Or.
So not really jumping country, is it?
Put in by chopper. Yeah. Rebellion.
Was that being considered at the time then, helicopter?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes.
Now, I know that around about this time we were beginning to experiment with delivering soldiers by helicopter, abseiling down ropes particularly into the Trudos Mountains, for example.
Yes.
Was that something that you got involved because of your connections with the Air Force at Odeon?
Not much. Not much. We paid respect to it, and we considered it and so on, but the actual details of that were left entirely to the units concerned.
So it's still really at tactical experiment level at that stage.
Yes.
What was it like at the Pakistan Air Force Staff College?
Well,
what impression did you get to the Pakistanis and their air force and their staff?
Well, I got on with them extremely well. There was a man called Air Commodore Bert Andrews, who was the British commandant of the Drigg Road Staff College in Karachi. And they were all a very pleasant crowd of people, and I found them extremely pro-British. Mm. It was only just after the Queen and Prince Philip had been to Karachi, and an enormous amount of loyalty to the Queen Memsahib was being shown. So much, I was put in charge of a man called Wing Commander Asghar Khan, and he said to me one day, he said, "I must take you," he said, "and show you where I saluted the Queen Memsahib." And so we had to go to this place in Karachi where he saluted the Queen Memsahib. And so he said, "And now we'll go back to my bungalow." So this is the days off that we had. So back to the bungalow, and he bolted the door. I thought, "Oh my goodness, now what?" You know, went to his sideboard and produced a litre of whiskey. So I said, "Asghar Khan, you must remember this. I am allowed to drink this, but you're not. When I'm the British officer, I drink whiskey." So I thought to myself, well, the things we do for Queen and country. But they were very loyal indeed. But it was so sad, I mean, the mess. They were trying to keep it up to the British standards. All the tablecloths had holes in them and so on and so forth. You know. It was very sad indeed. But they were trying to be very British indeed. And certainly the Pakistani army officers that I met were all tremendous, like the old days of the Indian Army that I'd known in 1945, 1946.
Pakasabs.
Called absolute Pakasabs, yes. and very proud of the history of their regiments.
And what about the Air Force? I mean, what condition was that in? Did you get an impression?
Well, yes. I mean, it was a pretty ropey Air Force.
Oh, was it?
It was in those days, yes. Mm. It was only just about getting back on its feet again, really. Mm. I mean, admittedly, they've had an Air Force for about, I suppose, what, 12 years or 10 years, something like that.
Yes. But what sort of aircraft were they flying at that time?
More or less strings and struts. I mean,
really?
It very, very...
Old British types.
Old British types, yes, mm. yes. They were, I think they were getting their aircraft, really, from either Russia or China, I think, something like that. Mm. But they may be getting them from our own country, I don't know.
Mm. What about their staff college? I mean, did you get an idea of what their syllabus was like?
Not really, no. I mean, I was only there for about a fortnight. Mm. And, I mean, I used to attend one or two of their lectures and so on, but I was told it was the same as RAF Bracknell.
They were just trying to carry on.
Carry on, yes. Mm. That's why they still had this Bert Andrews in charge. Mm. And he was the last British commandant, I think, there. Mm. Very pleasant man indeed.
Was there any sense of tension there about relations with India?
With India, I didn't sense it at all. Well, Kashmir was on the go, yes. Mm. But there was nothing like it is now, today, where, I mean, they're at each other's throats. Now, when did they have the first Indian-Pakistan war? Not long after that, I think it was.
Well, 1948, they had a fight in Kashmir, and the demarcation line was more or less established.
Yes, yes.
And then they had a war in 1965.
Well, that had gone over, you see, because it was in that's right. This is before that.
Yes.
5 years before that.
5 years before that. A big war in 65, and then another one, of course, in 71.
In 71, yes, mm. yes, yes. But one rather left the subject of India alone mm. for political reasons.
Did they not raise the question of India then as a subject?
Oh, they said, yeah, well, they did. They said, you know, certainly I remember one chap saying in one of his lectures, you know, mm. I'm afraid the time will come probably when we have to have a war with India mm. because of Kashmir and so on and so forth. But it would no more than that. So obviously it was on their contingency planning list, I'm quite sure.
Yes.
Quite certain.
Were they worried at all about the northwest frontier, the frontier with Afghanistan?
The Pathans and all that mm. sort of bit? Not really, no. No, you see, because the only northwest frontier campaigns that you and I knew in the days of the Raj, before the war, they didn't take place. Mm. I mean, I think the Pathans rather liked having the Pakistanis there. They didn't think they beat them up at all, or mm. took for them at all.
Well, there was a consistency of religious belief. Wasn't got, there?
That's right. Yes. That all helps. Yes. Mm. But I'm very glad to have been to Pakistan, even though it was only a short time.
G2 Airways, it seems that you were hardly at home, you're always travelling.
That's right, I was. So there's mm-hmm. two years I was continually on the go. Mm. I mean, literally at a moment's notice, this chap, Vice Marshal Wynne, would say, oh, Bill, go and grab a comet and go to Cyprus, or grab a comet and go to Aden, whatever it was. That was his great expression, grab whatever it was.
Were we air trooping by comet at that time?
Yes. And I had a pass signed by this chap, and I could get onto any RAF aircraft in the world mm. at the expense of somebody else. I'd reduce my permit, and I'd have to be given a seat.
Now, this is the time, I think, when we were thinking about replacing sea trooping by air trooping generally for virtually all purposes. Mm. Did you get involved in that?
No.
Planning for that?
No. That was still at MOD level. Hadn't come down to it went to staff level outside MOD at that time, or Air Ministry, War Office, call it what you like.
I suppose also it might have been more in the field of your RASC colleague rather than...
Rather, very much so, yes.
But you were concerned really more with operational...
Operational airborne warfare, yes. Mm. And the kit that was required for it, etc.
Who were you reporting to? Were you reporting to the air staff or were you reporting back through the army chain?
Well, we reported... We were commanded, the group was commanded by an Air Vice Marshal.
Yeah.
Wickham Barnes by name, another mm. Battle of Britain pilot. And